after we were married, even I had been a recipient of their warmth and affection. They were our family in Utah, and they were Mormon. On the way home, Sesh must have told me about Mormons, but I don't remember. Subsequently, I read some brochures about Mormons and their prophet Joseph Smith before I came to Utah in December 1969, 3 months after Sesh did. I'm certain Weber State College did not send them to me. It must have been Sesh. Upon arrival in September 1969, he must have visited his favorite haunts of old, which included the LDS temple grounds. It turned out to be the first in a new series of interminable tours. For every time we have guests from India, we schedule one visit to the Salt Lake Temple Square. Once a guest of mine responded, "I'm not interested in any church or temple. We have plenty in India. I want to see the canyons." I looked at her sternly and said, "You wouldn't visit Rome and refuse to see the Vatican, would you?" We visited the temple on our way to the Kennecott copper mines. Immigrants come to the United States with outlandish ideas and expectations about the country, even the educated ones. I am a classic example. I was an assistant professor of English at Osmania University, but I had little real knowledge about the country we were immigrating to. My idea of the USA, Utah included, was that it was a very advanced and therefore a totally democratic country where everyone, women, minorities, every citizen had equal rights. Little did I know that I had landed among the Mormons, one of the most patriarchal of religious communities. I was in for many surprises. Within a week after I arrived in Ogden, Dr. Lawan Carroll, a colleague at Weber State, told me that she made at least $2,000 less in salary than her male colleagues of equal training and experience. I had hoped that Sesh in private would refute her charges, but he had not. He had confirmed that American women did not have equal rights legally or professionally. "That is one of the reasons salaries are confidential," he had said. I was despondent about my fallen state as a woman. That was my first culture shock as we tried to settle down in the first few weeks after my arrival. Most women I met seemed to be either unaware of their secondary status or did not mind it. So, when friends asked me solicitously, "What were your first culture shocks?" I would respond politely, "Not any. I already knew a lot about America through my study of American literature." I would cite the comparative affluence of even the poorest people in the USA as a kind of pleasant culture shock, which pleased my friends. But this major shock about my deprived status as a woman, I kept hidden from others. My second major culture shock has to do with my recognition of the hegemony of Mormon beliefs in Utah's public life. That one came to me slowly and in spurts. It sometimes drove me to the edge of despair. In December 1969, when I boarded the Boeing 747 bound for New York on my way to Utah, I had not the faintest idea that religious bickering of any kind would engage my attention more than fleetingly. Joseph Campbell, in an essay titled "The Confrontation of East and West in Religion," written in 1970, says that in the early 1920s of his youth, and I quote him, "We were all perfectly sure that the world was through with religion. Science and reason were now in command. The First World War had been won, and the earth made safe for the rational reign of democracy." What I understood from it was that the world was through with public display and assertion of religion, which is essentially a private pursuit of individuals seeking spiritual guidance and salvation. There would be no more public skirmishes or wars about religions, no crusades, no jihads, no holy wars of any kind. How wrong I was. Take the case of proselyting by Mormons. Coming as I did from India, which does not allow or did not allow mission work of any kind, I had thought that missionaries had gone the way of dinosaurs. When one of my students told me in early 1970 that he had just come back from an LDS mission, I thought to myself, oh no, the poor kid was banished to Latin America as convicts were banished in the 19th century from England to Australia. What a barbarous custom. Very, very slowly did it dawn on me that serving a mission was supposed to be an honor. Even more slowly did I realize that all missionaries are expected to extol their own religion by putting down others' way of worship. I'm still intrigued at the evangelical zeal of institutionalized religions, and I'm sometimes sad that in the very act of enforcing righteousness our way, we negate the spirituality and truth of all religions, including our own, spirituality that is everywhere around us, if only we care to see. That the enthusiastic practicing Mormon does not miss a single opportunity to proselyte can be seen from my experience on my very first day in the USA, even before I reached my home in Ogden. On the United Airlines flight from New York to Salt Lake City, on a very snowy and cold day in December 1969, I happened to sit next to a dignified gentleman from southern Utah. Exhausted from my continuous intercontinental flight, I'd fallen soundly asleep, even as the domestic flight began, to be woken up for dinner. This gentleman and I fell to talking after dinner was served on flight. At the earliest opportunity, he asked me whether I was a Hindu. I was wearing a gorgeous Kanchipuram silk of navy blue and gold color and a dot or bindi on my forehead. I must have looked like a spectacle in my foreign clothes, a goodly target to spread the true word. My travel companion began tracking right away. He wanted to know what the dot on my forehead meant. He told me he was a Mormon. He was actually a bishop, he said with some pride. Did I know about Mormons? Yes, indeed, I said. I'd heard about prophets Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and how the latter had helped turn a desert into a lush, green, bounteous valley in Utah. LDS is the fastest growing religion in the world, he said pointedly. You might want to read more about it and visit the Temple Square in Salt Lake City. Even as I was talking to him, there sprang from the depths of my memory a talk I'd had 6 or 7 years earlier in India with Professor William Mulder, himself a Mormon, who had just become the first director of the American Studies Research Center in Hyderabad and who had previously been at Osmania University in Hyderabad as a Fulbright visiting professor. At a dinner hosted by the American Cultural Center, he was telling me about Mormon polygamy and how, in spite of its being banned legally, it was still practiced in some places. What about women? I asked innocently. How many women practice polyandry? He was nonplussed. Women were not allowed to marry more than one man at a time, he said. Women did not have the same choices, I exclaimed, perplexed. I had touched a raw nerve in him. He had been taken aback by my simple assumption that women in Utah had the same rights as men. We both laughed nervously and started talking about other things. Now, on my flight bound for Utah, that conversation suddenly fell in place. Disparate and stray bits of conversation about Mormons, outlandish comments about them made by our American friends in Hyderabad, and a couple of Salt Lake Temple brochures about prophets Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, read in haste as I was in the throes of packing and vanishing away an entire household, began to take interesting tones. Sometimes I wonder how other non-white immigrants like us have fared in Utah. Did they suffer any pressures because they were people of color? How did they respond to the Book of Mormon dictum from 2 Nephi? And I'm quoting, and he had caused the cursing to come upon them, that's on the Lamanites, yea, even a sore cursing because of their iniquity. Wherefore, as they were white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, that they might not be enticing unto my people, the Lord God did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them. Close quote. I often realize how naive I was when I immigrated and how many of my traumas and surprises, some of which are not relevant in this essay, would have been mitigated had I taken the trouble to be better informed. But my topic here is my escapades with the Mormons. My escapades are not physical, they're emotional, they're spiritual, they're at a level where they hurt and linger the longest. As a liberal practicing Hindu, I have no difficulty accepting the divinity of Jesus, Muhammad, the Buddha, or Zoroaster. A verse in one of the Upanishads, loosely translated, says, "Call your God by any name you want, worship your God in any manner you want. As long as your worship is sincere, all worship flows unto me," end of quote. And this me is nameless. A total belief in the wisdom of this verse has helped me to be genuinely ecumenical. A concept I find difficult to accept is that Jesus is the only Son of God. Even harder is the Mormon practice of offering prayers only in the name of Jesus, not even God. I'm not sure Jesus would have approved of the practice, even though he did say, "I and my Father are one." As the controversy on public prayer has increased in recent years, and it seems very likely that the Utah legislature is close to allowing school prayers, I find myself asking many questions. In all my 24 years in Utah, I have heard public prayers offered generically to God or the Great Spirit only 3 times. The first was by Robert Arway, then the director of the Honors Program at Weber State, followed by Levi Peterson, my colleague, and now chair of the English department at Weber State University, and finally, myself. Every other prayer, frequent in the days before prayers became suspect, was offered in the name of Jesus Christ. Sitting in my black academic robes at commencement time at Weber State, with over 2,000 students of all religions, Buddhists, Christians, Hindus, Jews, Muslims, Native Americans, Taoists, and others in the graduating class, I would wince at the insensitivity of offering prayers always in the name of Jesus Christ. In grade schools, prayers offered only from the point of one denomination or religion can be truly damaging to the spiritual growth of religion, of children of other religions. We have stopped referring to physicians and lawyers as he, even the generic he, and nurses and secretaries as she, because we have now come to recognize beyond doubt that such language restricts the social and professional horizons of little girls and truly devastates their self-esteem. Similarly, hearing prayers offered only in the name of Jesus Christ over and over again daily is bound to devalue other religions in the minds of those who hear them. What responsibility does the state have not to marginalize other religions under the guise of promoting freedom of religion? The practice of offering Christian prayers in classrooms is not fair to children of other religions. The psychological damage of such actions cannot be measured accurately. I doubt an average Mormon school teacher would willingly offer a prayer directed simply to God, a term many religious people could relate to. Then again, proselyting is too deeply ingrained in Mormon culture. As an educator, I worry about the prayer issue a great deal. Every new immigrant needs a mentor who helps the novice ease into the alien society in which one has chosen to make one's home. These mentors are not available in a supermarket, unfortunately. Perhaps they can be found in a church. But I had no church or temple of my own. In fact, I have the dubious distinction of being the first Hindu woman in a sari who made Ogden her home. But I had the good fortune to be assigned a welcome wagon hostess named Mary Rouse, who soon took the place of mentor and surrogate mother. She eased me into all the rituals one has to observe to be accepted into a new society. Mary Rouse was my link to understanding both the Mormon and non-Mormon communities. Mary was the daughter of an Englishman who converted to Mormonism and emigrated to Utah in the 1890s. Disenchanted with the LDS faith within 2 or 3 years, he had asked to be excommunicated. Thereafter, said Mary, he was threatened with life, mistreated by his once fellow Mormons, who resorted to the meanest tricks to scare him out of Utah or make him join their fold again. But he had succeeded in eluding them, she said. I said to her half jokingly, but half seriously too, it appears nobody can really elude them. Your late dad and you and I are all likely to be posthumously baptized. Not my dad, she said. He gave them all a piece of his mind. But Mary was wrong. In the LDS Church genealogical library in Salt Lake City with her daughter-in-law one summer, she discovered to her horror that her dad had indeed been posthumously rebaptized. She flew into a rage. I think she even wrote to the church authorities about this violation of a person's wishes. I must confess, I have been bothered by this possibility. With all respect for the LDS people, I do not condone their zeal for baptism of the dead. Having declined opportunities to convert to Mormonism in my full consciousness in this life, I would feel truly violated if baptized posthumously. Once Sesh asked me, are you going to let someone else's futile actions dislodge your spiritual equilibrium? But for me, it is not just a question of spiritual equilibrium, it is a question of the church's civic integrity and my civil rights accruing from the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. I shall not be converted against the wishes of my living body. But civil and legal rights aside, I also believe that all human beings will be treated fairly and justly by a just God. You might say, I believe implicitly in equal rights of all people in the spiritual realm and in the eyes of God. Insisting that a specific subgroup has a franchise on something special in the hereafter is like insisting that the blood of some humans is differently constituted than that of others, especially minorities. About 20 years ago, one of my students enrolled in a college writing course followed me out of class one day and said, Mrs. Seshachari, you believe in reincarnation, don't you? I was momentarily nonplussed, since her question had nothing to do with anything we had discussed in class. Seeing my confusion, she asked, aren't you a Hindu? I said, yes, but I didn't have to believe in reincarnation to be one. Now it was her turn to be confused. Didn't Hindus believe in reincarnation? So I explained how Hinduism had no articles of faith like the 39 articles in Anglicanism or the 13 articles in Mormonism. Even though most Hindus did believe in reincarnation, every Hindu was free to choose one's own specific beliefs, including agnosticism or even atheism as one's own path to salvation, or combine various paths as one felt inclined. She asked, wouldn't you like to be with your family when you go up there? Meaning after death. She explained how she was born a Catholic but had converted to Mormonism just before she married a Mormon. Her first son had died in childbirth. She said she was mighty glad she was Mormon because now she would be able to see him in the hereafter. Had she remained a Catholic, her son would have been in purgatory for time and all eternity, she said with conviction, and she would have had to pray for him eternally. I told her I didn't think God would make an innocent baby suffer in purgatory for an eternity just because his parents belonged to this or that religion. I was sure God had the same treatment for all virtuous mortals in the hereafter. If there was only one path leading to salvation, I said, God in infinite goodness would have revealed that path to every one of us. Since God had not done so, I chose to spend my daily life morally, spiritually, and intellectually as best I could, and leave the questions of the afterlife to God's goodness and justness. I'll take care of my pennies, I said, and God will take care of my dollars in the hereafter. She was spellbound. What you say makes sense, she said, but if I tell my husband what you said, he will not let me come to college. I was scared. Everyone's religion is true for each one, I added hastily. Your faith gives you courage to face life's vicissitudes, and that's what one's religion should do. Be a good Mormon, I said as we parted. Only two times in my 24 years have I been visited by missionaries. The first time, it was a pastor who stopped his car abruptly on seeing me dressed in a sari standing in the large bay window of a duplex apartment on 22nd and Harrison Street and Boulevard in Ogden and walked to our doorstep. Once he was seated in our living room, he waved his Bible at us and said, "Do you know what this book is?" I assured him I did. "I don't know anything about your religion, but this here Bible says it's the only true word of God." I told him politely that if he had cared to read about other religions, he might have heard similar claims. In fact, many people in the world, religious leaders, kings, and some others, claim to be direct sons of God. We were about to go out when he invaded our privacy, and he seemed reluctant to leave until he had lassoed us into the faith. I had to tell him, finally, that if he gave me equal time to hear about my religion, he might find himself giving up his own. But that was not my intent, nor the teaching of my religion. He's the only one in my memory I wished goodbye before he got up from the sofa. And no, he was not Mormon. I think he was a Seventh-day Adventist. The Mormon pair rang our doorbell in the late 1980s. I was genuinely pleased to see them. "You must be LDS missionaries," I said, when I saw them so well-groomed and polite. I asked them where they were from. One was from Arizona and the other from right here in southern Utah. "Too bad," I said, "you didn't get to visit an exotic country in Europe or Latin America." When asked, I assured them I owned not one, but two copies of the Book of Mormon. One was at home and the other in my office. I assured them, too, that we had genuine respect for Mormons and their prophets. On his earlier visit to Utah, my husband had been specially impressed with President McKay, who exerted, and he says continues to exert, a moral and spiritual influence on him. And we had many Mormon friends. "Did we have any questions about the Book of Mormon?" one of them ventured. "No," I said, "none whatsoever." They left graciously, asking me to contact them if I had any questions. Only about 10 days ago, I saw a couple of young missionaries walking past our home when Sesh was out working in the yard, and I was working on my paper. "Did you talk to those two missionaries?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "They were about to ring our doorbell, and I saw them and talked to them for about 10 or 15 minutes. They're good kids, just a couple of years out of MIA. When we moved into our present neighborhood, one of the reasons we were attracted to the area was an abundance of children of school-going age and the excellent reputation of the schools. We moved into the neighborhood in late summer, just before school began. And indeed, our 9-year-old daughter, Rathi, did make a number of friends. Within months after our move, however, she asked if she could go with her friends to the primary. "My friends are all coaxing me to go with them," she added. We were naturally alarmed. I remembered my friend Jeannie telling me how she had been baptized against the wishes of her parents when she was very young. She had hurt her parents grievously and had been traumatized by that experience in her adult years. It had all started with a simple invitation to her to attend the primary. It took us 2 days of arduous self-questioning and reflection to come to the conclusion that if we prevented our child from going, she would probably be attracted to it all the more. We argued with ourselves in karmic fashion, as only a Hindu can, that if she were destined to be a Mormon, we probably would not be able to prevent her baptism. In any case, she needed some spiritual instruction and plenty of discipline. Reluctantly, we told her she could go. And she did for about 5 or 6 weeks. Then one Wednesday, she came home at a time which was late from school, but not late enough from primary. She told me she had dodged her friends because she didn't feel like going to the primary. The following week, she asked me to tell her friends that she was not home. "I won't tell a lie," I said. "If you don't want to go, you should tell them so. Why don't you want to go anyway?" I added. "Mommy," said my 9-year-old, "they tell me there is only one way to worship God. Even I know there are many ways. Even my primary teacher doesn't know as much as I do. So she stayed home Wednesdays, and her friends increasingly stayed away from her. Not until church authorities admonished mothers in a semi-annual LDS conference did I know that indeed Mormon children were discouraged from playing with non-Mormon friends. Perhaps they still are. How is one to know? My child made other friends. Curiously, the girls were all non-Mormon, while the boys were both Mormon and Gentile. We had been afraid that our child might be drawn into the LDS faith before she was old enough to choose. She had declined to go to primary, but ideas about baptism must have fascinated her. There is something in rituals that a Hindu is naturally attracted to. One Wednesday, around 4 o'clock, I called home anxiously to find out what my 9-year-old was doing. I had been delayed on campus because of a meeting. "Oh, Mommy," she said, "I baptized Peppy." Peppy was our AKC, black and white Springer Spaniel. I had visions of the bathtub overflowing and water dripping all over in our carpeted bathroom, with Peppy running around everywhere in the house, vigorously frisking away water dripping from his body. "You baptized Peppy?" I asked, my voice rising as in a crescendo. "Oh, Mommy," she giggled, "I baptized him a Hindu. That's okay, isn't it?" "But how did you baptize him?" I asked weakly. "I put him in the broom closet and sprinkled water on him with my fingers, as you do in your puja." She beamed. "He loved it. He was wagging his tail and jumping all over and barking away, and his eyes were big and shining." I relaxed. No water. And mother and daughter both laughed and laughed in merriment. Mary and her husband Lowell were most amused at Peppy's baptism into the Hindu faith. They were both devout Presbyterians, but as Mary told me, she was increasingly beginning to realize that there was more to religion than what was being taught in churches. She was beginning to see for herself that the Bible contained contradictions and that churches exploited one or another dictum for their own advancement. She was fond of telling me that Brigham Young loved wine and that the LDS Church owned shares in the Coca-Cola company, even though its leaders did not want the faithful to drink Coke. "Do you find that ethical or moral?" she would ask over and over again. Mary and Lowell loved to come to our home occasionally when I had a puja, the formal Hindu worship ritual. And they were there not just to observe our Hindu ways as anthropologists study objects, but because they felt that they were part of our family as well and wanted to partake of our holy sacraments. I went with Mary to the Presbyterian Church on 28th Street on special occasions, and our daughter Rupa got married in their church with the Reverend Richard Henry of the Unitarian Church officiating and the Reverend Steiner of the Presbyterian Church offering the final benediction. Rupa and her groom, Eddie, had written their own wedding vows. With them, we felt a sense of community, which I define as a special psychological haven where everyone is cared for and accepted as is. Truly spiritual people, irrespective of their religious affiliations, should be able to get along without impinging on or devaluing one another's beliefs. We have a number of Mormon friends, too, with whom we feel the sense of community. They, too, have attended pujas at our home. Many of them, though not all, are the Sunstone Dialogue Exponent 2 variety of Mormons, if I may use such a term. Do we feel a sense of community with all Mormons? Probably not, but I feel safe in Mormon surroundings. Mormons are the most helpful and gracious people. I remember one summer in early 1980s when the water mains close to a new construction area near our home broke and the gushing waters cascaded into the basement of our neighbor's home on the other side of the street. Within minutes, there were about 50 or 60 people from the ward helping drain the water and pull furniture out of the flooded areas. Women were asked to volunteer to bring lunch for the workers, and I volunteered to take a couple of dozen sandwiches. This is the real social benefit of belonging to a ward, I told Sesh. They are like a big family. Every little thing from the basement of that large house had to be brought out and set on the grass in the front yard to dry. Soon, bottles of scotch whiskey, rum, gin, and beer began to appear. I was embarrassed for the family. How awful that their bishop was right there to see. My sympathies went out to the family, and I felt sorry for them doubly all day long. Later that evening, Sesh said, I want to give you some good news. The Carlyles, it turns out, are not Mormon. Stop worrying for them. One winter, a few years later, snow fell in Utah in such abundance that a couple of roofs in Ogden collapsed, and television and radio messages urged people to have their roofs shoveled. Sesh was away in New York and was not due home for 4 days, but I didn't panic. I knew what to do. I contacted our ward, and within hours, our roof was shoveled. The family who came to help said the snow had given them an opportunity to help their daughter, who had been called to serve a mission in Peru. I added $25 to the check I was writing for the work and told them it was for their daughter's mission. Finally, living with the Mormons hasn't always been easy, but it has often been fun. The first decade was the hardest for me in terms of personal and professional adjustments. But now my community knows me, and I know it. 2.5 decades of my community involvement have encouraged a healthy intimacy between me and my friends, who can even share a joke or banter about our different gods. I'm not sure I can say that I'm always comfortable with the Mormon cultural milieu, that changing, shifting, intangible reality often dictated by authorities above and enforced first at Brigham Young University. In some years, I have felt upbeat about the Mormon Church beginning to open up to the needs of women, other minorities, and cultural pluralism, while in other years, I have dreaded its conservative trends. Just this year, I have become uneasy again. When I hear of Pulitzer Prize-winning scholar Laurel Thatcher Ulrich not being allowed to speak on BYU campus, or of faculty who are most up-to-date on contemporary scholarship somehow seen not as scholarly enough to merit tenure, I become pensive. Did we do right in sinking roots here? But I tell myself, in which other state would we find such clean living, gracious, and loving people with whom we genuinely share so many values? I look forward to seeing a more tolerant, more pluralistic, multicultural, ecumenical Utah with as much faith as the Latter-day Saints look forward to the second coming of Christ. Thank you.
Is Manny Gunn here? We did have a respondent scheduled, but I believe he had a conflict. I'm sure that we can take the remaining 15, 20 minutes with questions. I have a whole list myself, but I'll let you go to it first. Please address your questions in this microphone. Speak as clearly as you can, and remember that you're on the air. So. Okay, I'll start you off. I had the advantage of reading Neela's paper in advance, and I've been thinking about it for several days, particularly as a Utah Mormon who has uprooted and rerooted in my own faith, in my own hometown, and in ironic ways feel a real affinity toward the people outside who come from the outside. In that sense, I have a lot of personal questions for Neela, but initially, I would really like to understand maybe India and the Hinduism a little bit better, especially in regard to possibly the most distinct affinities that we might have as two separate cultures. Can you help us understand? And also, I had a question that is based truly on my ignorance of Indian culture. Most many press accounts of things, situations in India lead me to understand that there's some very difficult gender issues and gender problems in India as well. I'd like to maybe understand some of the important differences to help us understand our own gender biases, our own gender concerns. And maybe you can follow up on that. I'd appreciate it.
I think I'll first address the question of gender bias in India. And of course there is gender bias. There is no place on earth where there is no gender bias. But legally in India, women are given all the rights that men have. Equal Rights Amendment is written into the Constitution of India, and you are free to go and read it. Constitutions are really not very big by nature, and you would be able to find the exact clause. And I think there is one additional term which says not on account of religion or place of birth or whatever, that men and women have equal rights. But do women have equal rights in reality? Probably no, I think, and that's a question of that's a question of economics. Any person who is dependent on another for the next meal is likely to be exploited sometime or the other. And as women get more educated and as women become economically independent, then the question of real equality between men and women can be a genuine issue. Sometimes I ask my students, when they're very scared of equal rights, I say, do I have the economic power to check into a hotel tonight and move out from my family? Sure I do, but why do I not do it? Because there is something that binds me to my family. And it is not just a law which says the husband and wife shall live together. Yeah. So in reality, women who are economic burdens on themselves tend to be exploited. And there are plenty in India, as there are some here, or a diminishing number, I hope, in this country and everywhere else globally. But on paper, Indian women have the same legal rights as men do. And so I had thought when I immigrated here, we were immigrating to a very advanced country, and advancement meant that everyone had equal rights, that it was a fair country, that everyone had equal, men and women had equal opportunities, that men and women were paid equally for the same kinds of jobs and so on. And that was my big culture shock, as I said earlier.
Can you hear me from here? Do you think there's any possibility that women could play some role in India in bridging the gaps between the Hindu and the Muslim populations in India? Here women have often tried to be agents of peacemaking, as in Northern Ireland, for example. And as you know, there are severe problems of between the Hindus and the Muslims. And do you think women could play a role there in doing something to dull the edges of violence, which are so tragic in India?
That's a good question. Let me repeat the question for radio audiences. The question was, can women in India do anything to mediate between the Hindus and Muslims who are into this terrible fight, just as Irish women in Ireland have mediated? And I think the answer is really far too complex and perhaps even beyond me, because it needs an understanding not just of religions and economics and politics and a whole lot of things, but also it's a question of when and how women might get equal status with men. India, as we all know, is a developing country, and the rich in India are indeed very, very rich, and the poor are enormously poor, horribly poor. And 25 years ago when we immigrated, the Hindus and Muslims did not fight that much. I remember some of my Muslim friends used to come to our place and partake of our sacraments, and we would ask. The Muslim women were not allowed to go to the mosque, otherwise I would have gone. For instance, here in the United States, I've been to Mormon sacrament meetings, and when bread and water came my way, I've taken them because I need blessings no matter where they come from. And I choose to go on Christmas Eve to the midnight mass in a Catholic church. And I do not go and take, for the communion there because I've not been to a confession the previous week. But that's in deference to their tradition. And I have given sermons at a Japanese Christian church and at the Unitarian church, if you can think of a sermon at a Unitarian church. But I'm genuinely ecumenical, and I'm in a sense representative of many people in India. It's very customary to say, who's your God, or which God do you worship? Knowing that God is one and the same, that God has many faces, 1,000 faces of God, and many genders of God, you might think. You might even think in those terms. I would say that in India, women are capable of playing a crucial role, but I do not know when it's going to come because somehow even religious dissension or religious quarreling is dependent on some kind of economics too. It's a power play. And politicians have exploited these situations and have turned Hindus against Muslims and Muslims against Hindus. So it's very... It's a difficult question, but I think women are capable of mediating because women, in a sense, are people who can relate to others a little more easily than men can. Or so far, they've been trained to relate. I think birthing and nurturing of children somehow enables women to relate to others in other situations. I don't know if I've satisfied you, Jean.
I've wondered about your time that you spent at Stanford and if the experience that you had there was perhaps more what you anticipated when you came to America, or you might compare what you found there at Stanford and what you found here.
I didn't get the question exactly.
Can you compare your experience in Stanford?
Stanford?
As opposed to being in Utah.
Oh.
Of America.
Okay. My experience in Stanford is, I thought I heard Stanford. I was at Stanford I was a visiting scholar to the Center for Research on Women, and I was steeped in reading as many hours as I could put in. But there is at Stanford a chapel, and it's, I think, an interdenominational chapel. And I used to go there. And it's very strange. I'll give you an example. I was there just before Lent, and here was this ceremony being conducted in Hebrew. And I really didn't understand, but one can intuit. There's another language. You don't need actual words. You can understand. And I told myself, what is it that I like very much that I can't do without, and that I can do without for the next 40 days? And I remembered Sesh saying, you can't do without your coffee in the morning. And I told myself I would not drink coffee for the next 40 days. And I didn't even wish it. And I'm not Christian. I didn't have to go to confession. But I think all religions have that appeal, that ritual. And I don't know if that's because I'm a Hindu. But I think there's a lot of ecumenical feeling, even in Utah. At least the friends I've made, the friends I've met, the people I have affinity to, have a tremendous understanding of everyone's religions. And I don't think anybody has belittled or hurt me or, so I don't know if my experience at Stanford was any different from my experience in Utah. But I think we tend to be in Utah a little more when I talk of... Well, the average person in Utah The average Mormon in Utah is sometimes a little afraid to befriend a non-Mormon. Or perhaps I tell myself, the average Mormon is kept so busy doing church work that the average Mormon does not have time to socialize too much with other non-Mormons. But I have plenty of Mormon friends, you being one of them. And I've not felt a literal alien in this place. But again, I distinguish between Sunstone Dialogue Exponent 2 Mormons or Campus Mormons, whom I know well.
Nila said that she didn't feel much different at Stanford. I have been to many other places and lived outside of Utah for a long time. I do have to say that as long as I have lived in Utah as an immigrant, and it's now almost, 20 years or so, I still believe that I'm an outsider here, very much so, which I don't feel that way when I go outside of Utah. There is certainly because I'm not like them. I don't want to be like them if that means that I have to give up my own conviction and belief. Yeah. And I don't think that's fair to demand of me either because I'm not asking them to give up their conviction and belief. So there is that picture of two cultures, the insiders and the outsiders. And most of the immigrants, if they don't happen to be Mormons, they automatically end up being the outsider. Surely if you are a Mormon, then naturally the culture is there. This is the Mecca, so to speak. But otherwise, there is the definite insularity. But there are so many good things about Utah. When I go outside of Utah, I do miss Utah very much. I feel homesick. Once I was outside of Utah and felt homesick, and then I thought there was a movie about Utah, so I bought a ticket and went inside the theater. Lo and behold, the movie was not about Utah. It was about all these prehistoric animals. So I felt cheated. I wanted my money back. They said no. They couldn't give me my money back. But I thought that was false advertising because the name of the movie was The Land That Time Forgot. Anyway.
Oh. Well, Dean, I do agree with you. I have, in the past, felt a little out of place. 25 years ago, for instance, when we came, and then I decided to complete my PhD at the University of Utah and started attending the University of Utah, my friends would say, "My, you are ambitious." And that ambitious had a very pejorative ring to it. And within the next 5 minutes, they would say, "You know, my son is so ambitious. He's going to Washington University and he's doing his law school there." You know, there were two different yardsticks. Sometimes my friends would not understand why I couldn't go to a movie with them or go out to a lunch with them because I was writing a paper for a conference. On the other hand, they would say, "You know, Bob is writing this paper. Poor guy, he's sweating it out." And, you know, it was so obvious. But I think those differences are slowly, the gap is bridging. As more and more women are going out and becoming professionals, as we know, 9 out of 10 women in Utah in the 20th century have worked outside the home. And these are conservative statistics. And out of them, 9 out of 10 work for 30 or more years. And now women are beginning to realize that if one has to work, one had better be a professional and get the maximum paycheck because then it goes all into one's family and the family can reap benefits. I don't think professional women have too much time to curl their hair or paint their nails or do other things. They have time only to pour their earnings back into their families. So I have felt out of place. But my problems were in the first 10 years, in the first decade after we came. And we've lived here for 2.5 decades now. But the gap is closing in. And I feel quite happy in some years. And as I said, a little apprehensive in others. You know, when my colleagues have been asked not, when their when their contracts have not been renewed, I'm reminded that Utah can go very conservative at times. And then, karmic fashion, I might want to argue and say, well, it's like a wheel. Fate is like a wheel. Then pretty soon, the other side may come up. You know, we might find Utah Milu getting a little more accommodating or multicultural.
One final response and question, I guess, on my part. I agree there are two separate cultures here, and I felt very distinctly part of that and party to that being here. And I think there are other less visible cultures within those two as well that have similarities and differences throughout. My question to Nila, and really anyone who would like to respond, my children are very small. They're growing up in a very world that has been part of their heritage for many generations now. My greatest concerns as their mother truly are how I can teach them that ecumenical spirit, give them that in a society that is very homogeneous, in a world that to them right now, everyone looks like them, everyone sounds like they do. It's a very difficult question for me as their mother. How do I give them the multicultural spirit in a place that is very hard for them to see otherwise right now in a very small world that they live in? What are your suggestions?
I didn't face similar problems because we were the outsiders. But I think one of the things one might do is take your children on Christmas Eve to a Catholic mass. I think it's the parental attitude that determines how the children very often respond. Reach out in other ways and not treat them as if they were objects to show the difference and then assert, see how superior we are. I mean, that's any time I go to a ward, and I used to go to plenty, I've spoken to every relief society about India and about Hinduism, and I had this uncanny feeling that they were all very nice to me. I hope I'm wrong, okay? I had this feeling that the following week they would say, see, that is why our faith is so much better. They have only part of the truth, we have the whole truth. I had this feeling. I hope I'm wrong, but something tells me I'm not entirely wrong. So I think it's the parents' attitude. It helps create the milieu.
Thank you so much for your attendance. Hope to see you at other sessions. Thanks again.
Thank you.